On the whole, men are more good than bad. That, however, isn't the real point. But they are more or less ignorant, and it is this that we call vice or virtue, the most incorrigible vice being that of an ignorance that fancies it knows everything, and therefore claims for itself the right to kill. The soul of the murderer is blind, and there can be no true goodness or true love without the utmost clear-sightedness. Hence, the sanitary groups, whose creation was entirely Tarrou's work, should be considered with objectivity, as well as with approval. And this is why the narrator declines to vaunt in overglowing terms a courage and a devotion to which he attributes only a relative and reasonable importance. But he will continue being the chronicler of the troubled, rebellious hearts of our townspeople under the impact of the plague. Those who enrolled in the sanitary squads, as they were called, had indeed no such great merit in doing as they did, since they knew it was the only thing to do, and the unthinkable thing would then have been not to have brought themselves to do it. These groups enabled our townsfolk to come to grips with the disease, and convinced them that now that the plague was among us, it was up to them to do whatever could be done to fight it. Since plague became in this way some men's duty, it revealed itself as what it really was, that is, the concern of all. So far, so good. But we do not congratulate a schoolmaster on teaching that two and two make four, though we may, perhaps, congratulate him on having chosen his laudable vocation. Let us then say it was praiseworthy that Tahu and so many others should have elected to prove that two and two make four rather than the contrary. But let us add that this goodwill of theirs was one that is shared by the schoolmaster and by all who have the same feelings as the schoolmaster. And, be it said to the credit of mankind, they are more numerous than one would think. Such, anyhow, is the narrator's conviction. Needless to say, he can see quite clearly a point that could be made against him, which is that these men were risking their lives. But again and again there comes a time in history when the man who dares to say that two and two make four is punished with death. The schoolteacher is well aware of this. And the question is not one of knowing what punishment or reward attends the making of this calculation. The question is that of knowing whether two and two do make four. For those of our townsfolk who risk their lives in this predicament, the issue was whether or not plague was in their midst, and whether or not they must fight against it. Many fledgling moralists in those days were going about our town proclaiming there was nothing to be done about it and we should bow to the inevitable. And Tarrou, Rieu, and their friends might give one answer and another, but its conclusion was always the same. Their certitude that a fight must be put up in this way or that, and there must be no bowing down. The essential thing was to save the greatest possible number of persons from dying and being doomed to unending separation. And to do this, there was only one resource, to fight the plague. There was nothing admirable about this attitude. It was merely logical. Thus, it was only natural that old Dr. Castel should plod away with unshaken confidence, never sparing himself, at making anti-plague serum on the spot with the makeshift equipment at his disposal. Rieu shared his hope that a vaccine made with cultures of the bacilli obtained locally would take effect more actively than serum coming from outside, since the local bacillus differed slightly from the normal plague bacillus as defined in textbooks of tropical diseases, and Castel expected to have his first supply ready within a surprisingly short period. That, too, is why it was natural that Grand, who had nothing of the hero about him, should now be acting as a sort of general secretary to the sanitary squads. A certain number of the groups organized by Tarrou were working in the congested areas of the town with a view to improving the sanitary conditions there. Their duties were to see that houses were kept in a proper hygienic state and to list attics and cellars that had not been disinfected by the official sanitary service. Other teams of volunteers accompanied the doctors on their house-to-house visits, saw to the evacuation of infected persons, and subsequently, owing to the shortage of drivers, even drove the vehicles conveying sick persons and dead bodies. All this involved the upkeep of registers and statistics, and Grand undertook the task. From this angle, the narrator holds that, more than Rieu or Tarrou, Grand was the true embodiment of the quiet courage that inspired the sanitary groups. He had said yes without a moment's hesitation, and with the large-heartedness that was a second nature with him. All he had asked was to be allotted light duties. He was too old for anything else. He could give his time from 6 to 8 every evening. When Rieu thanked him with some warmth, he seemed surprised. "Why, that's not difficult. Plague is here, and we've got to make a stand. That's obvious." I only wish everything were as simple. And he went back to his phrase. Sometimes in the evening, when he had filed his report and worked out his statistics, Grand and Rieu would have a chat. Soon they formed the habit of including Tarou in their talks, and Grand unburdened himself with increasingly apparent pleasure to his two companions. They began to take a genuine interest in the laborious literary task to which he was applying himself while plague raged around him. Indeed, they too found in it a relaxation of the strain. "How's your young lady on horseback progressing?" Tarou would ask. And invariably Grand would answer with a wry smile, "Trotting along, trotting along." One evening, Grand announced that he had definitely discarded the adjective elegant for his horsewoman. From now on, it was replaced by slim. "That's more concrete," he explained. Soon after, he read out to his two friends the new version of the sentence. One fine morning in May, a slim young horsewoman might have been seen riding a handsome sorrel mare along the flowery avenues of the Bois de Boulogne. "Don't you agree with me? One sees her better that way." And I've put "one fine morning in May" because "in the month of May" tended rather to drag out the trot, if you see what I mean. Next, he showed some anxiety about the adjective handsome. In his opinion, it didn't convey enough, and he set to looking for an epithet that would promptly and clearly photograph the superb animal he saw in his mind's eye. Plump wouldn't do, though concrete enough it sounded perhaps a little disparaging, also a shade vulgar. Beautifully groomed had tempted him for a moment, but it was cumbrous and made the rhythm limp somewhat. Then one evening he announced triumphantly that he'd got it, a black sorrel mare. To his thinking, he explained, black conveyed a hint of elegance and opulence. "It won't do," Rieu said. "Why not?" "Because sorrel doesn't mean a breed of horse. It's a color."
"What color?"
"Well, a color that anyhow isn't black." Grand seemed greatly troubled. "Thank you," he said warmly. "How fortunate you're here to help me. But you see how difficult it is." "How about glossy?" Tarou suggested. Grand gazed at him meditatively. Then, "Yes," he exclaimed, "that's good." And slowly his lips parted in a smile. Some days later, he confessed that the word flowery was bothering him considerably. As the only towns he knew were Oran and Montélimar, he sometimes asked his friends to tell him about the avenues of the Bois de Boulogne, what sort of flowers grew in them, and how they were disposed. Actually, neither Rieu nor Tarou had ever gathered the impression that those avenues were flowery, but Grand's conviction on the subject shook their confidence in their memories. He was amazed at their uncertainty. It's only artists who know how to use their eyes, with his conclusion. But one evening, the doctor found him in a state of much excitement. For flowery, he had substituted flower-strewn. He was rubbing his hands. At last, one can see them, smell them. "Hats off, gentlemen." Triumphantly, he read out the sentence. "One fine morning in May, a slim young horsewoman might have been seen riding a glossy sorrel mare along the flower-strewn avenues of the Bois de Boulogne." But, spoken aloud, the numerous S sounds had a disagreeable effect, and Grand stumbled over them, lisping here and there. He sat down crestfallen. Then he asked the doctor if he might go. Some hard thinking lay ahead of him. It was about this time, as was subsequently learned, that he began to display signs of absent-mindedness in the office. A serious view was taken of these lapses of attention, as the municipality not only was working at high pressure with a reduced staff, but was constantly having new duties thrust upon it. His department suffered, and his chief took him severely to task, pointing out that he was paid to do certain work and was failing to do it as it should be done. "I'm told that you're acting as a voluntary helper in the sanitary groups. You do this out of office hours, so it's no concern of mine. But the best way of making yourself useful in a terrible time like this is to do your work well. Otherwise, all the rest is useless." "He's right," Grand said to Rieu. "Yes, he's right," the doctor agreed. "But I can't steady my thoughts. It's the end of my phrase that's worrying me. I don't seem able to sort it out." The plethora of sibilants in the sentence still offended his ear, but he saw no way of amending them without using what were, to his mind, inferior synonyms. And that flower-strewn, which had rejoiced him when he first lit on it, now seemed unsatisfactory. How could one say the flowers were strewn when presumably they had been planted along the avenues, or else grew there naturally? On some evenings, indeed, he looked more tired than Rieux. Yes, this unavailing quest, which never left his mind, had worn him out. Nonetheless, he went on adding up the figures and compiling the statistics needed for the sanitary groups. Patiently, every evening, he brought his totals up to date, illustrated them with graphs, and racked his brains to present his data in the most exact, clearest form. Quite often, he went to see Rieux at one of the hospitals and asked to be given a table in an office or the dispensary. He would settle down at it with his papers, exactly as he settled down at his desk in the municipal office, and wave each completed sheet to dry the ink in the warm air, noisome with disinfectants and the disease itself. At these times, he made honest efforts not to think about his horsewoman and concentrate on what he had to do. Yes, if it is a fact that people like to have examples given them, men of the type they call heroic, and if it is absolutely necessary that this narrative should include a hero, the narrator commends to his readers with, to his thinking, perfect justice, this insignificant and obscure hero who had to his credit only a little goodness of heart and a seemingly absurd ideal. This will render to the truth its due, to the addition of 2 and 2 its sum of 4, and to heroism the secondary place that rightly falls to it, just after, never before, the noble claim of happiness. It will also give this chronicle its character, which is intended to be that of a narrative made with good feelings, that is to say, feelings that are neither demonstrably bad nor overcharged with emotion in the ugly manner of a stage play. Such, at least, was Dr. Rieux's opinion when he read in the newspapers or heard on the radio the messages and encouragement the outer world transmitted to the plague-ridden populace. Besides the comforts sent by air or overland, compassionate or admiring comments were lavished on the henceforth isolated town by way of newspaper articles or broadcast talks. And invariably their epical or prize speech verbiage jarred on the doctor. Needless to say, he knew the sympathy was genuine enough, but it could be expressed only in the conventional language with which men try to express what unites them with mankind in general, a vocabulary quite unsuited, for example, to Grand's small daily effort, and incapable of describing what Grand stood for under plague conditions. Sometimes at midnight, in the great silence of the sleep-bound town, the doctor turned on his radio before going to bed for the few hours' sleep he allowed himself. And from the ends of the earth, across thousands of miles of land and sea, kindly, well-meaning speakers tried to voice their fellow feeling, and indeed did so, but at the same time proved the utter incapacity of every man truly to share in suffering that he cannot see. Oran, Oran, in vain the call rang over oceans, in vain Rieux listened hopefully. Always the tide of eloquence began to flow, bringing home still more the unbridgeable gulf that lay between Grand and the speaker. Oran, we're with you, they called emotionally. But not, the doctor told himself, to love or to die together. And that's the only way. They're too remote. What has yet to be recorded before coming to the culmination, during the period when the plague was gathering all its forces to fling them at the town and lay it waste, is the long, heart-rendingly monotonous struggle put up by some obstinate people like Rambert to recover their lost happiness and to balk the plague of that part of themselves which they were ready to defend in the last ditch. This was their way of resisting the bondage closing in upon them. And while their resistance lacked the active virtues of the other, it had, to the narrator's thinking, its point. And moreover, it bore witness, even in its futility and incoherences, to a salutary pride. Rambert fought to prevent the plague from besting him. Once assured that there was no way of getting out of the town by lawful methods, he decided, as he told Rieux, to have recourse to others. He began by sounding café waiters. A waiter usually knows much of what's going on behind the scenes. But the first he spoke to knew only of the very heavy penalties imposed on such attempts at evasion. In one of the cafés he visited, he was actually taken for a stool pigeon and curtly sent about his business. It was not until he happened to meet Cottard at Rieux's place that he made a little headway. On that day, he and Rieux had been talking again about his unsuccessful efforts to interest the authorities in his case, and Cottard heard the tail end of the conversation. Some days later, Cottard met him in the street and greeted him with the hail-fellow-well-met manner that he now used on all occasions. "Hello, Rambert. Still no luck?" "None whatever." "Oh, it's no good counting on the red tape merchants. They couldn't understand if they tried." "I know that, and I'm trying to find some other way, but it's damn difficult.
Yes, Cortal replied, it certainly is. He, however, knew a way to go about it, and he explained to Humbert, who was much surprised to learn this, that for some time past he had been going the rounds of the cafes, had made a number of acquaintances, and had learned of the existence of an organization handling this sort of business. The truth was that Cotard, who had been beginning to live above his means, was now involved in smuggling ventures concerned with rationed goods. Selling contraband cigarettes and inferior liquor at steadily rising prices, he was on the way to building up a small fortune.
Are you quite sure of this? Humbert asked.
Quite. I had a proposal of the sort made to me the other day.
But you didn't accept it.
Oh, come. There's no need to be suspicious. Cotard's tone was genial.
I didn't accept it because, personally, I have no wish to leave. I have my reasons.
After a short silence, he added, You don't ask me what my reasons are, I notice.
I take it, Humbert replied, that they're none of my business.
That's so, in a way, of course. But from another angle, well, let's put it like this. I've been feeling much more at ease here since plague settled in. Humbert made no comment. Then he asked, And how does one approach this organization, as you call it?
Ah, Cotard replied, that's none too easy. Come with me.
It was 4 p.m. The town was warming up to boiling point under a sultry sky. Nobody was about. All shops were shuttered. Cotard and Humbert walked some distance without speaking under the arcades. This was an hour of the day when plague lay low, so to speak. The silence, the extinction of all color and movement, might have been due as much to the fierce sunlight as to the epidemic, and there was no telling if the air was heavy with menace or merely with dust and heat. You had to look closely and take thought to realize that plague was here, for it betrayed its presence only by negative signs. Thus Cotard, who had affinities with it, drew Humbert's attention to the absence of the dogs that in normal times would have been seen sprawling in the shadow of the doorways, panting, trying to find a non-existent patch of coolness. They went along the Boulevard des Palmiers, crossed the Place d'Armes, and then turned down toward the docks. On the left was a café painted green, with a wide awning of coarse yellow canvas projecting over the sidewalk. Cotard and Humbert wiped their brows on entering. There were some small iron tables, also painted green, and folding chairs. The room was empty, the air humming with flies. In a yellow cage on the bar, a parrot squatted on its perch, all its feathers drooping. Some old pictures of military scenes covered with grime and cobwebs adorned the walls. On the tables, including that at which Humbert was sitting, bird droppings were drying, and he was puzzled whence they came, until, after some wing flappings, a handsome cock came hopping out of his retreat in a dark corner. Just then the heat seemed to rise several degrees more. Cotard took off his coat and banged on the tabletop. A very small man, wearing a long blue apron that came nearly to his neck, emerged from a doorway at the back, shouted a greeting to Cotard, and vigorously kicking the cock out of his way, came up to the table. Raising his voice to drown the cock's indignant cacklings, he asked what the gentleman would like. Cotard ordered white wine and asked, Where's Garcia? The dwarf replied that he'd not shown up at the café for several days. Think he'll come this evening?
Well, I ain't in his secrets, but you know when he usually comes, don't you?
Yes. Really, it's nothing very urgent. I only want him to know this friend of mine. The barkeeper rubbed his moist hands on the front of his apron.
Ah, so this gentleman's in business, too.
Yes, Cotard said. The little man made a snuffling noise. All right, come back this evening. I'll send the kid to warn him. After they'd left, Humbert asked what the business in question might be.
Why, smuggling, of course. They get the stuff in past the sentries at the gates. There's plenty of money in it.
I see. Humbert paused for a moment, then asked, And I take it they've friends in court.
You've said it.
In the evening, the awning was rolled up, the parrot squawking in its cage, and the small tables were surrounded by men in their shirt sleeves. When Cotard entered, one man with a white shirt gaping on a brick-red chest and a straw hat planted well back on his head rose to his feet. He had a suntanned face, regular features, small black eyes, very white teeth, and 2 or 3 rings on his fingers. He looked about 30.
Hi, he said to Cotard, ignoring Humbert. Let's have one at the bar.
They drank 3 rounds in silence.
How about a stroll, Garcia suggested.
They walked toward the harbor. Garcia asked what he was wanted to do. Cottard explained that it wasn't really for a deal that he wanted to introduce his friend, Monsieur Humbert, but only for what he called a getaway. Puffing at his cigarette, Garcia walked straight ahead. He asked some questions, always referring to Humbert as he, and appearing not to notice his presence. Why does he want to go? His wife is in France.
Ah.
After a short pause, he added, what's his job?
He's a journalist.
Is he now?
Journalists have long tongues.
I told you he's a friend of mine, Cottard replied. They walked on in silence until they were near the wharves, which were now railed off. Then they turned in the direction of a small tavern from which came the smell of fried sardines. In any case, Garcia said finally, it's not up my alley. Raoul's your man, and I'll have to get in touch with him. It's none too easy.
That's so, Cottard sounded interested.
He's lying low, is he?
Garcia made no answer.
At the door of the tavern, he halted, and for the first time addressed Humbert directly. The day after tomorrow, at 11, at the corner of the customs barracks in the upper town. He made as if to go, then seemed to have an afterthought.
It's going to cost you something, you know.
He made the observation in a quite casual tone. Humbert nodded, naturally. On the way back, the journalist thanked Cottard.
Don't mention it, old chap. I'm only too glad to help you. And then you're a journalist. I dare say you'll put in a word for me one day or another.
2 days later, Humbert and Cottard climbed the wide, shadeless street leading to the upper part of the town. The barracks occupied by the customs officers had been partly transformed into a hospital, and a number of people were standing outside the main entrance, some of them hoping to be allowed to visit a patient, a futile hope since such visits were strictly prohibited, and others to glean some news of an invalid, news that in the course of an hour would have ceased to count. For these reasons, there were always a number of people and a certain amount of movement at this spot, a fact that probably accounted for its choice by Garcia for his meeting with Humbert. It puzzles me, Cottard remarked, why you're so keen on going.
Really, what's happening here is extremely interesting.
Not to me, Humbert replied.
Well, yes, one's running some risks, I grant you. All the same, when you come to think of it, one ran quite as much risk in the old days crossing a busy street.
Just then, Rieux's car drew up level with them. Tarou was at the wheel, and Rieux seemed half asleep. He roused himself to make the introductions.
We know each other, Tarou said. We're at the same hotel.
He then offered to drive Humbert back to the center.
No, thanks. We've an appointment here.
Rieux looked hard at Humbert.
Yes, Humbert said.
What's that? Cottard sounded surprised. The doctor knows about it?
There's the magistrate. Tarou gave Cottard a warning glance.
Cottard's look changed. Monsieur Auton was striding down the street toward them, briskly yet with dignity. He took off his hat as he came up with them.
Good morning, Monsieur Auton, said Tarou.
The magistrate returned the greeting of the men in the car, and turning to Humbert and Cottard, who were in the background, gave him a quiet nod. Tarou introduced Cottard and the journalist. The magistrate gazed at the sky for a moment, sighed, and remarked that these were indeed sad times. I've been told, Monsieur Tarou, he continued, that you're helping to enforce the prophylactic measures. I need hardly say how commendable that is. A fine example. Do you think, Dr. Rieux, that the epidemic will get worse?
Rieux replied that one could only hope it wouldn't, and the magistrate replied that one must never lose hope. The ways of Providence were inscrutable.
Tarou asked if his work had increased as a result of the present conditions.
Quite the contrary. Criminal cases of what we call the first instance are growing rarer. In fact, almost my only work just now is holding inquiries into more serious breaches of the new regulations. Our ordinary laws have never been so well respected.
Well, that's because, by contrast, they necessarily appear good ones, Tarou observed. The magistrate, who seemed unable to take his gaze off the sky, abruptly dropped his mildly meditative air and stared at Tarou.
What does that matter?
It's not the law that counts, it's the sentence. And that is something we must all accept.
That fellow, said Tarou when the magistrate was out of hearing, is enemy number one.
He pressed the starter. Some minutes later, Humbert and Cottard saw Garcia approaching. Without making any sign of recognition, he came straight up to them and, by way of greeting, said, you'll have to wait a bit. There was complete silence in the crowd around them, most of whom were women. Nearly all were carrying parcels. They had the vain hope of somehow smuggling these into their sick relatives, and the even crazier idea that the latter could eat the food they'd brought. The gate was guarded by armed sentries. and now and then an eerie cry resounded in the courtyard between the barracks rooms and the entrance. Whenever this happened, anxious eyes turned toward the sick wards. The three men were watching the scene when a brisk good morning from behind them made them swing round. In spite of the heat, Raoul was wearing a well-cut dark suit and a felt hat with rolled-up brim. He was tall and strongly built, his face rather pale. Hardly moving his lips, he said clearly and quickly, "Let's walk down to the center. You, Garcia, needn't come." Garcia lit a cigarette and remained there while they walked away. Placing himself between Rambert and Cottard, Raoul set the pace, a fast one. "Garcia's explained the situation," he said. "We can fix it. But I must warn you, it'll cost you a cool 10,000. Rambert said he agreed to these terms. "Lunch will be tomorrow at the Spanish restaurant near the docks." Rambert said, "Right," and Raoul shook his hand, smiling for the first time. After he had gone, Cottard said he wouldn't be able to come to lunch next day as he had an engagement. But anyhow, Rambert didn't need him anymore. When, next day, Rambert entered the Spanish restaurant, everyone turned and stared at him. The dark, cellar-like room below the level of the small yellow street was patronized only by men, mostly Spaniards, judging by their looks. Raoul was sitting at a table at the back of the room. Once he had beckoned to the journalist and Rambert started to go toward him, the curiosity left the faces of the others and they bent over their plates again. Raoul had beside him a tall, thin, ill-shaven man with enormously wide shoulders, an equine face, and thinning hair. His shirt sleeves were rolled up, displaying long, skinny arms covered with black hair. When Rambert was introduced, he gave three slow nods. His own name, however, was not announced, and Raoul, when referring to him, always said, "Our friend." "Our friend here thinks he may be able to help you. He's going..." Raoul broke off as the waitress had just come to take Rambert's order. "He's going to put you in touch with two of our friends who will introduce you to some sentries whom we've squared. But that doesn't mean you can start right away. You'll have to leave it to the sentries to decide on the best moment. The simplest thing will be for you to stay some nights with one of them. His home is quite near the gate. The first thing is for our friend here to give you the contacts needed. Then, when everything's set, you'll settle with him for the expenses." Again, the friend slowly moved his equine head up and down without ceasing to munch the tomato and pimento salad he was shoveling into his mouth. After which, he began to speak with a slight Spanish accent. He asked Rambert to meet him the next day but one at 8 in the morning in the cathedral porch. "Another 2 days' wait," Rambert observed. "It ain't so easy as all that, you see," Raoul said. "Them boys take some finding." Horseface nodded slow approval once more. Some time was spent looking for a subject of conversation. The problem was solved easily enough when Rambert discovered that Horseface was an ardent football player. He, too, had been very keen on soccer. They discussed the French championship, the merits of professional English teams, and the technique of passing. By the end of the meal, Horseface was in high good humor, was calling Rambert old boy and trying to convince him that the most sporting position by far on the football field was that of center half. "You see, old boy, it's the center half that does the placing, and that's the whole art of the game, isn't it?" Rambert was inclined to agree, though he personally had always played center forward. The discussion proceeded peacefully until the radio was turned on, and, after at first emitting a series of sentimental songs, broke into the announcement that there had been 137 plague deaths on the previous day. No one present betrayed the least emotion. Horseface merely shrugged and stood up. Raoul and Rambert followed his example. As they were going out, the center half shook Rambert's hand vigorously. "My name's Gonzalez," he said. To Rambert, the next 2 days seemed endless. He looked up Rieu and described to him the latest developments, then accompanied the doctor on one of his calls. He took leave of him on the doorstep of a house where a patient suspected to have plague was awaiting him. There was a sound of footsteps and voices in the hall. The family were being warned of the doctor's visit. "I hope Tarou will be on time," Rieu murmured. He looked worn out. "Is the epidemic getting out of hand?" Rambert asked. Rieu said it wasn't that. Indeed, the death graph was rising less steeply. Only they lacked adequate means of coping with the disease. We're short of equipment. In all the armies of the world, a shortage of equipment is usually compensated for by manpower. But we're short of manpower, too. Haven't doctors and trained assistants been sent from other towns? Yes, Leo said. 10 doctors and 100 helpers. That sounds a lot, no doubt. But it's barely enough to cope with the present state of affairs, and it'll be quite inadequate if things get worse. Robert, who had been listening to the sounds within the house, turned to Rieu with a friendly smile. "Yes," he said, "you'd better make haste to win your battle." Then a shadow crossed his face. "You know," he added in a low tone, "it's not because of that I'm leaving." Rieu replied that he knew it very well. But Robert went on to say, "I don't think I'm a coward, not as a rule, anyhow. And I've had opportunities of putting to the test. Only there are some thoughts I simply cannot endure." The doctor looked him in the eyes. "You'll see her again," he said. "Maybe. But I just can't stomach the thought that it may last on, and all the time she'll be growing older. At 30, one's beginning to age, and one's got to squeeze all one can out of life. But I doubt if you can understand." Rieu was replying that he thought he could when Tarou came up, obviously much excited. "I just asked Banlou to join us." "Well?" asked the doctor. He thought it over, then said yes. "That's good," the doctor said. "I'm glad to know he's better than his sermon." "Most people are like that," Tarou replied. "It's only a matter of giving them the chance." He smiled and winked at Rieu. "That's my job in life, giving people chances." "Excuse me," Rambert said, "and I've got to be off." On Thursday, the day of the appointment, Rambert entered the cathedral porch at 8:05. The air was still relatively cool. Small, fleecy clouds, which presently the sun would swallow at a gulp, were drifting across the sky. A faint smell of moisture rose from the lawns, parched though they were. Still masked by the eastward houses, the sun was warming up Joan of Arc's helmet only, and it made a solitary patch of brightness in the cathedral square. A clock struck 8. Rambert took some steps in the empty porch. From inside came a low sound of intoning voices, together with stale wafts of incense and dank air. Then the voices ceased. 10 small black forms came out of the building and hastened away toward the center of the town. Rambert grew impatient. Other black forms climbed the steps and entered the porch. He was about to light a cigarette when it struck him that smoking might be frowned on here. At 8:15, the organ began to play very softly. Rambert entered. At first he could see nothing in the dim light of the aisle. After a moment he made out in the nave the small black forms that had preceded him. They were all grouped in a corner in front of a makeshift altar on which stood a statue of St. Roque, carved in haste by one of our local sculptors. Kneeling, they looked even smaller than before, blobs of clotted darkness hardly more opaque than the gray, smoky haze in which they seemed to float. Above them, the organ was playing endless variations. When Rambert stepped out of the cathedral, he saw Gonzalez already going down the steps on his way back to town. "I thought you'd cleared off, old boy," he said to the journalist, "considering how late it is." He proceeded to explain that he'd gone to meet his friends at the place agreed on, which was quite nearby, at 7:50, the time they'd fixed, and waited 20 minutes without seeing them. "Something must have held them up. There's lots of snags, you know, in our line of business." He suggested another meeting at the same time on the following day beside the war memorial. Rambert sighed and pushed his hat back on his head. "Don't take it so hard," Gonzalez laughed. "Why, think of all the swerves and runs and passes you got to make to score a goal." "Quite so," Rambert agreed, "but the game lasts only an hour and a half." The war memorial at Oran stands at the one place where one has a glimpse of the sea, a sort of esplanade following for a short distance the brow of the cliff overlooking the harbor. Next day, being again the first to arrive at the meeting place, Rambert whiled away the time reading the list of names of those who had died for their country. Some minutes later, 2 men strolled up, gave him a casual glance, then, resting their elbows on the parapet of the esplanade, gazed down intently at the empty, lifeless harbor. Both wore short-sleeved jerseys and blue trousers, and were of much the same height. The journalist moved away, and, seated on a stone bench, studied their appearance at leisure. They were obviously youngsters, not more than 20. Just then, he saw Gonzalez coming up. "Those are our friends," he said, after apologizing for being late. Then he led Rambert to the 2 youths, whom he introduced as Marcel and Louis. They looked so much alike that Rambert had no doubt they were brothers. "Right," said Gonzalez. "Now you know each other, you can get down to business." Marcel, or Louis, said that their turn of guard duty began in 2 days and lasted a week. They'd have to watch out for the night when there was the best chance of bringing it off. The trouble was that there were 2 other sentries, regular soldiers, besides themselves at the West Gate. These 2 men had better be kept out of the business. One couldn't depend on them, and anyhow it would pile up expenses unnecessarily. Some evenings, however, these two sentries spent several hours in the back room of a nearby bar. Marcel, or Louis, said that the best thing Robert could do would be to stay at their place, which was only a few minutes' walk from the gate, and wait till one of them came to tell him the coast was clear. It would then be quite easy for him to make his getaway. But there was no time to lose. There had been talk about setting up duplicate sentry posts a little farther out. Robert agreed and handed some of his remaining cigarettes to the young men. The one who had not yet spoken asked Gonzalez if the question of expenses had been settled, and whether an advance would be given. No, Gonzalez said, you needn't bother about that. He's a pal of mine. He'll pay when he leaves. Another meeting was arranged. Gonzalez suggested their dining together on the next day but one at the Spanish restaurant. It was an easy walking distance from where the young men lived. For the first night, he added, I'll keep you company, old boy. Next day, on his way to his bedroom, Robert met Tarou coming down the stairs at the hotel. Like to come with me, he asked. I'm just off to Sirieux. Robert hesitated. Well, I never feel sure I'm not disturbing him. I don't think you need worry about that. He's talked about you quite a lot. The journalist pondered. Then, look here, he said, if you've any time to spare after dinner, never mind how late, why not come to the hotel, both of you, and have a drink with me? That will depend on Rieu. Tarou sounded doubtful. And on the plague, said Tarou. At 11 o'clock that night, however, Rieu and Tarou entered the small, narrow bar of the hotel. Some 30 people were crowded into it, all talking at the top of their voices. Coming from the silence of the plague-bound town, the two newcomers were startled by the sudden burst of noise and halted in the doorway. They understood the reason for it when they saw that liquor was still to be had here. Robert, who was perched on a stool at a corner of the bar, beckoned to them. With complete coolness, he elbowed away a noisy customer beside him to make room for his friends. You've no objection to a spot of something strong? No, Tarou replied, quite the contrary. Rieu sniffed the pungency of bitter herbs in the drink that Robert handed him. It was hard to make oneself heard in the din of voices, but Robert seemed chiefly concerned with drinking. The doctor couldn't make up his mind whether he was drunk yet. At one of the two tables that occupied all the remaining space beyond the half-circle round the bar, a naval officer with a girl on each side of him was describing to a fat, red-faced man a typhus epidemic at Cairo. They had camps, you know, he was saying, for the natives, with tents for the sick ones and a ring of sentries all around. If a member of the family came along and tried to smuggle in one of those damn fool native remedies, they fired at sight. A bit tough, I grant you, but it was the only thing to do. At the other table, round which sat a bevy of bright young people, the talk was incomprehensible, half drowned by the stridence of St. James Infirmary coming from a loudspeaker just above their heads. Any luck? Rieu had to raise his voice. I'm getting on, Rambert replied, in the course of a week, perhaps. A pity, Tarou shouted. Why? Oh, Rieu put in. Tarou said that because he thinks you might be useful to us here. But personally, I understand your wish to get away only too well. Tarou stood the next round of drinks. Robert got off his stool and looked him in the eyes for the first time. How could I be useful? Why, of course, Tarou replied, slowly reaching toward his glass, in one of our sanitary squads. The look of brooding obstinacy that Robert so often had came back to his face, and he climbed again onto his stool. Don't you think these squads of ours do any good? Asked Tarou, who had just taken a sip of his glass and was gazing hard at Robert. I'm sure they do, the journalist replied, and drank off his glass. Rieu noticed that his hand was shaking, and he decided definitely that the man was far gone in drink. Next day, when for the second time Robert entered the Spanish restaurant, he had to make his way through a group of men who had taken chairs out on the sidewalk and were sitting in the green-gold evening light enjoying the first breaths of cooler air. They were smoking an acrid-smelling tobacco. The restaurant itself was almost empty. Robert went to the table at the back of which Gonzalez had sat when they met for the first time. He told the waitress he would wait a bit. It was 7:30. In twos and threes, the men from outside began to dribble in and seat themselves at the tables. The waitresses started serving them, and a tinkle of knives and forks, a hum of conversation, began to fill the cellar-like room. At 8, Robert was still waiting. The lights were turned on. A new set of people took the other chairs at his table. He ordered dinner. At 8:30, he had finished without having seen either Gonzalez or the two young men. He smoked several cigarettes. The restaurant was gradually emptying. Outside, night was falling rapidly. The curtains hung across the doorway were billowing in a warm breeze from the sea. At 9, Rambert realized that the restaurant was quite empty and the waitress was eyeing him curiously. He paid, went out, and, noticing that a cafe across the street was open, settled down there at a place from which he could keep an eye on the entrance of the restaurant. At 9:30, he walked slowly back to his hotel, racking his brains for some method of tracking down Gonzalez, whose address he did not know, and bitterly discouraged by the not unlikely prospect of having to start the tiresome business all over again. It was at this moment, as he walked in the dark streets along which ambulances were speeding, that it suddenly struck him, as he informed Dr. Rieu subsequently, that all this time he'd practically forgotten the woman he loved, so absorbed had he been in trying to find a rift in the walls that cut him off from her. But at this same moment, now that once more all the ways of escape were sealed against him, he felt his longing for her blaze up again, with a violence so sudden, so intense, that he started running to his hotel as if to escape the burning pain that nonetheless pervaded him, racing like wildfire in his blood. Very early next day, however, he called on Rieu to ask him where he could find Cottard. "The only thing to do is to pick up the thread again where I dropped it." "Come tomorrow night," Rieu said. "Tarou asked me to invite Cottard here. I don't know why. He's due to come at 10. Come at 10:30. When Cottard visited the doctor next day, Tarou and Rieu were discussing the case of one of Rieu's patients, who against all expectation had recovered. "It was 10-1 against," Tarou commented. "He was in luck." "Oh, come now," Cottard said. "It can't have been the plague, that's all." They assured him there was no doubt it was a case of plague. "That's impossible, since he recovered. You know as well as I do. Once you have the plague, your number's up." "True enough, as a general rule," Rieu replied. "But if you refuse to be beaten, you have some pleasant surprises." Cottard laughed. "Precious few, anyhow. You saw the number of deaths this evening." Tarou, who was gazing amiably at Cottard, said he knew the latest figures and that the position was extremely serious. "But what did that prove?" "Only that still more stringent measures should be applied." "How? You can't make more stringent ones than those we have now." "No, but every person in the town must apply them to himself." Cottard stared at him in a puzzled manner, and Tarou went on to say that there were far too many slackers, that this plague was everybody's business, and everyone should do his duty. For instance, any able-bodied man was welcome in the sanitary squads. "That's an idea," said Cottard, "but it won't get you anywhere. The plague has the whip hand of you, and there's nothing to be done about it." "We shall know whether that is so," Tarou's voice was carefully controlled, "only when we've tried everything." Meanwhile, Rieu had been sitting at his desk copying out reports. Tarou was still gazing at the little businessman, who was stirring uneasily in his chair. "Look here, Monsieur Cottard, why don't you join us?" Picking up his derby hat, Cottard rose from his chair with an offended expression. "It's not my job," he said. Then, with an air of bravado, he added, "What's more, the plague suits me quite well, and I see no reason why I should bother about trying to stop it."